The headlines to start: Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi warns that any possible invasion of the country, even the smallest scale, will be met with a crushing response. Tensions between Beijing and Washington rise to new unprecedented levels as the U.S. aircraft carrier returns to the South China Sea amid China's condemnation. And North Korea's leader heats up rhetoric against the U.S. in a speech on the Korean War Armistice anniversary. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian president says any invasion of the country, even in the smallest scale, will be met with a harsh response by Iran, which will make the perpetrators regret deeply. Ebrahim Raisi said that is why the thought of invading the country never crosses anyone's mind these days. The Iranian president made the remarks while visiting Hamadan province. Raisi said Iran's progress in the defense industry has a deterrent goal and aims to neutralize the enemy's sanctions against the country. He said that Iran is a source of security in West Asia. Earlier this month, President Joe Biden said that the U.S. could use force to confront Iran's nuclear program. He made the threat in a visit to occupied Palestine, underlining Washington's commitment to, quote, never allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon. Tehran has reiterated that its nuclear program is for purely peaceful purposes and that it has no intention of developing nuclear weapons. Toyed Asari, academic and political analyst, joins us. You have Iran's president making statements regarding the way that Iran's defense industry works and its approach towards, obviously, that arena is a message to the enemies of Iran. Who in particular do you think Iran is sending a message to?
Well, the truth of the matter is that the statements that appeared recently from Iranian President Raisi comes from a grand strategy that is the basis of Iranian foreign policy, security policy, and defense policy when it comes to formulation and when it comes to practice as well. And this fundamental core, which has this push for Iran has taken decades to come to, is that if you want to have security, if you want to defend your country, it's all something built in capability, and it's not an item to be purchased. So on that basis, the Islamic Republic has done a lot of effort in order to develop its own defense capabilities. But on that, there are, I think, two basically important considerations. The first one is the constant threats that Iran's rivals, including the United States and other countries, have directed towards the Islamic Revolution, which contains a very long list, including sanctions, including direct military attacks against the sovereignty of the Iranian nation, and including a wide spectrum of tools in U.S. foreign policy toolbox in order to go against Iran and in order to attack Iran in any possible direction, either in a conventional or unconventional way. So this is one important issue. And then the second issue is that, specifically if you take a look at the history of Islamic Republic in the past four decades, even though the country has never started any war, any invasion against any other country, either in West Asia or elsewhere, the country has been constantly under attack, and on the other hand, lack of commitment is something that is for Iran a key important aspect of foreign policy formulation, meaning that even though Iran has fulfilled all its commitments based on different agreements, including JCPOA or other agreements that Iran has been a signatory of, the fact is that when it comes to foreign relations, Iran has experienced this kind of betrayal from other countries, mostly including the West. So that is another further reason that makes Iran further determined in order to develop its own defense capabilities.
Thank you very much for that. Toyed Essedi, academic and political analyst. Thank you. Iranian police say that they have arrested five network agents trained by the Israeli spy agency Mossad to carry out acts of terror and sabotage in Iran. Law enforcement authorities say that the head of the ring and four other members were arrested. The detainees have been identified as members of Komala terrorist group led by Mossad for sabotage in Iran. Police officials say that they intercepted their attempted contact with Mossad and were able to monitor their activity. Iranian security forces also confiscated advanced equipment and phone cards. Tensions between Beijing and Washington have once again come to the fore as the U.S. aircraft carrier and strike group return to the South China Sea. China has condemned the presence of U.S. warships as a threat to regional peace.
China's position on this issue is consistent and clear. The United States once again sent an aircraft carrier to the South China Sea to show off its muscles. We can clearly see who is the biggest threat to peace and stability in the South China Sea and Asia.
The deployment of the USS Ronald Reagan to the disputed region comes amid a row between the two powers over a potential upcoming visit to Taiwan by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. China has warned that it would take countermeasures if Pelosi lands on the island. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory, believes that U.S. military and political support for the island emboldens its pro-independence forces.
Tensions are rising between China and the United States. Beijing has issued a stern warning against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Chinese Taipei. Beijing says that Washington will be responsible for the consequences of the possible visit. Chinese side has made it clear to the U.S. that it is firmly opposed to Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. We are fully prepared. If the U.S. goes its own way, China will certainly take firm and forceful measures to safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity, and the U.S. should be held responsible for any serious consequences.
So the idea that she would visit Taiwan at this point is intended to provoke a crisis with China. Recall that the U.S. and the British forced NATO expansion, totally ignoring Russia's security interests with the so-called reverse Cuba Missile Crisis, whose purpose was to provoke Russia into acting against the neo-Nazi regime in Ukraine. In order to justify the wildly illegal and self-defeating sanctions, economic warfare against Russia.
Analysts believe the latest warning by China against the visit of the U.S. House Speaker to Chinese Taipei was harsher in tone and very stern. Some say the threats contained an allusion to a possible military confrontation between China and the U.S., and that is why reservations have been raised in Washington about the visit. The U.S. House Speaker was scheduled to visit Taipei earlier in April, but the trip was apparently canceled after she contracted COVID. However, some reports say that Pelosi will make the controversial visit in August. Apart from top Democrats, some hawkish Republicans have also come out in favor of the visit, stressing that this visit is a show of support against China.
This is a very serious crisis. How China responds is very difficult to foresee, but it's a moment in which the literally madmen and women in the West are trying to do to China what they are in the process of doing against Russia.
There are few people today who doubt that China is a global superpower, both militarily and economically. China's economy has continued to grow over the past few decades and is well on its way to overtake the U.S. by the year 2030. Following details in the report are supportive of those statements.
There are few people today who doubt that China is a global superpower, both militarily and economically. In terms of the economy, China's economy has continued to grow over the past few decades and is well on its way to overtake the U.S.'s by the year 2030. In terms of military and technology, China is now a superpower on par with the U.S., although Washington's military budget is still the largest in the world. Politicians in Washington who are still dreaming of a unipolar world order that came into existence following the collapse of the Soviet Union do not tolerate the rise of China. The first sign of the unease began to emerge after the former U.S. President Barack Obama announced his pivot to Asia policy, which was meant to counter China's rising influence. Obama's successors, Trump and Biden, have continued Washington's anti-China rhetoric. The two superpowers are locked over a number of issues, including trade and the South China Sea. The bone of contention is Chinese Taipei, and Beijing has made it very clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to become independent.
It really can only be averted at this point by the nations of the West recognizing that they have no solution to the now terminal breakdown of the dollar system, the hyperinflationary collapse, other than sitting down with Russia and with China in a new Bretton Woods conference to replace the now completely broken and destroyed Bretton Woods system that was set up by Franklin Roosevelt and has been systemically taken apart over these last 30 years.
Chinese Taipei is under China's sovereignty and under the One China policy. The United States and other countries have recognized that sovereignty. But Washington, in violation of its own stated policy, and in an attempt to irritate Beijing, has increased diplomatic contact with the Chinese Taipei.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says that his country is ready to mobilize its nuclear war deterrent and is prepared for any military clash with the U.S. Kim was speaking at an event marking the 69th anniversary of the Korean War Armistice. He also warned that South Korean administration and military could be annihilated if it makes what he called dangerous attempts. Kim's speech came after Seoul and Washington said Pyongyang had completed preparations to conduct its first nuclear test since 2017. South Korea also said the North could face more sanctions if it conducts the test. North Korea says its nuclear program is for self-defense against threats posed by the U.S. and its regional allies. Pyongyang is particularly opposed to joint war games by Washington and Seoul.
South Korea will soon resume large-scale military exercises with the United States. Seoul's recently appointed foreign minister Wednesday met with the foreign press and explained the importance of the U.S. alliance in the drills.
We expect that the Ministry of National Defense will resume training to maintain the South Korea-U.S. combined defense capabilities so that South Korea's security can be maintained.
The South Korean envoy placed the responsibility for subsequent military tension on North Korea.
North Korea's nuclear and missile development and provocations are the most important causes of tension on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korea recently resumed ballistic missile testing after a self-imposed moratorium aimed at negotiating a lifting of U.S.-led sanctions, which remain in effect. Meanwhile, South Korea's further developed and tested missile technology and deployed several advanced U.S. weapon systems, raising concern in Pyongyang.
The U.S. and its allies are increasing their military pressure on our republic. All this is raising serious concern that the ravages of the war 72 years ago could be repeated here. Our measures to build up national defense capabilities are the legitimate and righteous exercise of our sovereignty to defend our national security and territory against military threats.
South Korea said this year's drills will include 11 field exercises, amphibious operations, and an air carrier strike group. South Korean officials have said the joint military exercises with the U.S. will begin on August 22nd. And for the first time since 2018, include field training. As new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol pivots to a hardline approach to Pyongyang, inter-Korean ties appear destined for greater tension. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Not to Ukraine, where the Russian military has taken the country's second largest power plant. Ukraine has confirmed the capture of the plant in the eastern Donetsk region, calling it a tiny tactical advantage for Russia. Kiev also says that Russia is redeploying its troops to three southern regions, Melitopol, Zaporizhzhia, and Kherson. An advisor to the Ukrainian president says the redeployment seems to be a switch from offense to strategic defense. Ukraine has already said that it intends to recapture Kherson, which fell to Russia in the early days of the war. country also says its forces have killed dozens of Russian troops in the past 24 hours. The Ukraine war is now in its sixth month. Ukraine says that it will increase electricity exports to the European Union as the bloc faces an energy crisis triggered by reduced gas supplies from Russia.
We are preparing to increase our electricity exports to consumers in the European Union. Despite the war, we secured the connection of the Ukrainian power grid to the entire European energy system in a record time. Our exports allow us not only to generate foreign currency revenues, but also help our partners withstand Russian energy pressure.
Zelensky added that his country will become one of the guarantors of European energy security. The Ukrainian power grid was connected to the European network in mid-March. The connection enabled Ukraine to receive electricity from Europe if military attacks caused outages. In early July, Ukraine started exporting electricity to the EU via Romania. On Wednesday, Germany said Russia has cut gas deliveries to Europe via the Nord Stream pipeline to about 20% of capacity, down from 40%. EU countries accused Russia of reducing gas supplies in response to Western sanctions imposed on Moscow over the Ukraine war. Moscow, however, blames technical issues with the pipeline for the gas supply cuts. And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Despite the strong rhetoric by European leaders, their preparedness for extreme weather events was shown to be inadequate. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Sasha Bromsky, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "Roads are literally melting in Europe during unprecedented heat wave." Here's the story.
Thank you.
European countries are facing much more frightening emergencies as fires engulfed swathes of forest in Spain, Portugal, Greece, Hungary, and France, and as the extreme heat triggered house fires and wildfires in and around London. Europe is finally waking to the ghastly realities of the climate crisis and the rampant fires that come with it. After days of record-breaking temperatures, calamitous forest fires and mounting numbers of deaths associated with the heat, French President Emmanuel Macron called for the creation of a European-wide firefighting air fleet. Europe's leaders have realized that the continent has got to play catch-up to shore its infrastructure and to protect its fire-vulnerable lands from wildfire. European countries currently spend only 0.4% of their budgets on firefighting services. The German federal government has repeatedly refused to invest in firefighting aircraft, apparently believing the country is unlikely to face the sorts of mega fires that routinely consume vast tracts of land in the US and Australia. France does have one of Europe's best equipped firefighting fleets, but it tops out at 22 planes. In addition to the national fleets such as the one France has, the entire EU currently has a dozen firefighting planes that are pooled for use across national boundaries during fire emergencies. Now, as heat waves become more common and more ferocious in Europe, the continent's governments, both in national capitals and in Brussels, headquarters of the EU, will also have to adjust upward the amounts they invest in fire prevention services, as well as in frightening equipment and personnel. It will inevitably put a strain on state budgets, and will do so just at the moment when the continent is teetering on the edge of recession and is being battered by stubbornly high inflation. Taken as a whole, Europe has been caught remarkably unprepared by July's heat wave. Thousands of people, most of them elderly, died last week as the blast of hot air moved slowly northward from the Mediterranean. The human dislocation that the heat caused has also threatened to magnify Europe's already stark economic woes. Its currency in decline against the dollar, inflation running at above 9%, its loss of stable supplies of Russian gas and oil. If Europe does fall into a severe recession later this year, no single factor will be to blame. But the heat to the region's economy brought on by a string of debilitating heat waves will certainly be one of the causes of contributing to the malaise. Heat is something of a relative concept. In California or Texas, in Arizona or Oklahoma, summer temperatures a few degrees north of 100 degrees Fahrenheit would barely raise eyebrows. Even higher temperatures such as the 120 degrees Fahrenheit, sometimes reached in Las Vegas, Phoenix, or Tucson, don't tend to do quite the same damage that soaring temperatures inflict in Europe. In the American West, populations are accustomed to such temperatures, and houses, public transport systems, office buildings, entertainment centers, malls, and so on are designed to include air conditioning. By contrast, in Europe, most buildings, both public and private, do not have air conditioning. Many transit systems are similarly lacking, and populations are woefully unfamiliar with how to navigate extremely hot weather. Moreover, electricity prices have soared so quickly in Europe this past year that even those with air conditioning have had to think twice before using their systems. Electricity wholesale prices rose more than 400% in Spain and Portugal from the winter of 2021 through early 2022, and by more than 300% in Greece and France. While not all of that has been passed on to consumers, much has. In the 12 months leading up to March of this year, home energy prices around the EU increased by 41%. Since then, as gas and oil prices have soared, they have gone up still higher. Faced with shortages of Russian natural gas, the EU has announced a rationing plan to try to cut usage by 15% over the coming month. Vastly increased reliance on air conditioning simply isn't possible in Europe at the moment, given current energy supply and price conditions. When the heat soared to around 104 degrees Fahrenheit in London, the agency responsible for managing London's complex public transport system was forced to urge people not to use its on-air conditioned buses and trains. Faced with lack of staff coming into work, many businesses shuttered. In Scotland, the government appealed to the public to cut down on alcohol consumption so as to avoid inebriated people becoming dehydrated in the unusual heat. And the London Fire Brigade was experiencing its busiest day since the Second World War, as more than 40 properties burned and numerous parks and heaths blazed in the fierce heat. At Luton Airport, just outside of London, outbound flights were cancelled and incoming flights had to be diverted after a runway buckled in the heat. Railway tracks around the country also started to fail. Put simply, the UK's infrastructure simply isn't built to withstand triple-digit temperatures. Despite the strong rhetoric by European leaders, the continent's preparedness for extreme weather events was shown to be inadequate. In the US, activists are pressuring Biden to declare a climate emergency. The crisis in Europe is worsening seemingly by the day. This past week is a preview of just how bad things can get. It's far past time to tackle this catastrophe with the focus and urgency it so clearly merits.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wassalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now, we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kadhim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: لا تبذل لإخوانك من نفسك ما ضره عليك أكثر من منفعته لهم.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "Do not give away of yourself to your brothers so much that the loss incurred by you supersedes the benefit to them."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we talk about the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the seventh divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, we find that the idea of remembering death and remembering the grave and remembering the hereafter are concepts and ideas and themes which are repeated by every single immaculate and infallible Imam and, of course, the divinely appointed prophets and messengers of Allah, including the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. So in one gathering, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam attended the funeral services of an individual who had passed away. Now, as is in any funeral service, of course, many people had gathered around the person who had died, and they were about to lower this individual into the grave. And while the people were lowering this dead person into their grave, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam said an amazing thing. He said, "Surely the thing whose end is this is worthy of abstaining from, and surely the thing whose beginning is this is entitled to be feared." So once again, I just want to kind of take you to the scene that was happening. This individual had died and they were lowering them into the grave. And so Imam al-Kadhim says that the end of something is this death and lowering into the grave. Now, what is that thing which the end is the grave? That is the dunya, the materialistic world. And so Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says that the end of the materialistic physical aspect of this world, the end is the grave. And if the end of this materialistic, selfish, consumeristic world is the grave, then surely it is worthy of abstaining from. because it ends in the grave. But then Imam al-Kadhim says that the thing whose beginning is this death, this grave, what is the beginning? The beginning that starts at death, and that is the hereafter. That is the movement towards the ultimate day of judgment. And here Imam al-Kadhim says that the day of judgment and death and the afterlife, the hereafter, whose beginning is this death and this grave, surely must be feared. But the fear, dear friends, is not enough. We must also work actively, ask for forgiveness, make amends, and take a new step towards Allah in order to safeguard our hereafter. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
If each and every one of us rose to the responsibility and understood from the life of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far and his companions and what he did, then our situation will be much better. What did Imam Musa ibn Ja'far do? First of all, he made sure that there was a man by the name of Ali ibn Yaqtin. Yaqtin, the father of Ali ibn Yaqtin, used to trade in fragrance, in atar. And at the time of the Umayyads, or the Umayyads, he used to come out and he used to praise Bani Hashim and curse the Umayyads. And what happened therefore was that the Abbasids, when they attained power, when they got the power, they loved him, they liked him, because he had spoken against the Umayyads. And therefore, they wanted to appoint his son Ali to take a ministerial position. Imam was approached by Ali ibn Yaqtin. Ali ibn Yaqtin asked him, Yabna Rasulullah, what should I do? Should I take this position or not? Imam said to him, Ala anna lillahi awliya'a fi abwab al-zalama. Surely Allah will have friends where? At the doors that belong to the oppressors. In other words, you go ahead, yet with a condition. And the condition is, when someone comes to you, one of the believers, and requires something to be done and completed or fulfilled, you should not hesitate. And you should do it. In other words, you should facilitate. You should make things easy for people. And indeed, this is what we find that the Imam alayhi salam demonstrated. Someone came to him from Ahwaz. He said to him, Yabna Rasulillah, I am in great debt. And the governor in Ahwaz is one of your followers. He is one of those who loves the Ahlul Bayt. I want you to write a letter to him. Maybe he will remove some of the loans and the debts that are incurred upon me. Imam alayhi salam writes a letter. The letter is two sentences. The letter states, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has reserved paradise for those who alleviate the suffering of their brothers and sisters. Khalas, that's it.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The battle to become Britain's next Prime Minister descended into fierce clashes on Monday night, 25th of July, as Rishi Sunak launched repeated attacks on the economic policies of the favourite, Liz Truss, in their first head-to-head television debate. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Rajiv Sial, Ben Quinn and Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled Truss and Sunak Trade Blows in Acrimonious First TV Debate. The battle to become Britain's next Prime Minister descended into fierce clashes on Monday night, 25th of July, as Rishi Sunak launched repeated attacks on the economic policies of the favourite, Liz Truss, in their first head-to-head television debate. The two Conservative leadership hopefuls traded blows over tax cuts, over China and inflation, with the former Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, accusing the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, of seeking a short-term sugar rush by cutting national insurance. Liz Truss accused her former cabinet colleague of raising taxes to their highest level for 70 years. The exchanges at the BBC debate followed a weekend of deeply personal attacks, with Sunak criticised over his wealth and his wardrobe, as Liz Truss faced claims she was economically illiterate while being reminded that she was formerly a Remainer. Rishi Sunak, widely seen as having to make up crucial ground to win over the Conservative membership, who will vote on from 5th of August, repeatedly described his opponent's plans on the economy as not conservative, interrupting her at one point to say, "You promised almost £40 billion of unfounded tax cuts, £40 billion more borrowing. This is the country's credit card. It's our children and grandchildren. Everyone's here who are going to have to pick up the tab for that." Liz Truss hit back over Rishi Sunak's calls for a tougher stance on China, pointing out that the Treasury just last month was calling for closer bilateral and economic ties. Rishi Sunak accused his opponent of making pronouncements about a golden era between China and Britain. "I think that was almost a decade ago," the Foreign Secretary snapped back. Amid reports that Boris Johnson has not yet ruled out a political comeback, despite pledging to step down next month, both candidates also ruled out a role for the current Prime Minister in any government they might lead. "I'm sure he will have a role. I'm sure he will be vocal, but he will not be part of the government," said the Foreign Secretary, despite emphasising that she had been an early supporter of Boris Johnson's. She contrasted her continuing loyalty to him to those of others, adding that it would have been a dereliction of duty not to remain in her post. According to the Daily Telegraph, Boris Johnson told Lord Cruddas at Chequers over lunch on Friday that he wants to fight the next general election as leader of the Conservative Party. Lord Cruddas confirmed. Lord Cruddas is running a campaign to give Conservative Party members a vote on whether to accept Boris Johnson's resignation as Tory leader. But Downing Street responded by insisting that Johnson will leave the post when a new leader is chosen. On Boris Johnson, Liz Truss told the debate, Having spent time with him this week on foreign affairs, I very much suspect that he would not want a future role in the government. He needs a well-earned break. Rishi Sunak, whose resignation from cabinet on the same day as Sajid Javid precipitated the ousting of Boris Johnson, paid tribute to Johnson as remarkable, but said he had reached a point where enough was enough. I thought all the things that were going on the conduct side, were not right, and we clearly had different views on the economy side, he said. But with postal ballots set to arrive on Tory members' doorsteps by 5th of August, Rishi Sunak faced pressure to use the BBC debate and another hosted by Talk TV and The Sun on Tuesday to make an early breakthrough. Although he comfortably won the leadership race among Tory MPs, Liz Truss is the favourite to win after a series of opinion polls and surveys put her firmly ahead with party members. Perhaps as a result of this pressure on Rishi Sunak, the debate was particularly bad-tempered, with a former chancellor often interrupting Liz Truss. At one point she said, "Under my plans, we would start paying back the debt in 3 years' time, so I'm not putting it on the never-never." The former chancellor interrupted, saying, "That's simply not right," adding, "You promised almost £40 billion of unfunded tax cuts, that is the country's credit card." Liz Truss hit back, saying, "Rishi, that is not true. Under my plans, we would start paying down the debt in 3 years' time. COVID was a 1-in-100-years event. No other country is putting up taxes at this moment." The Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, has described Rishi Sunak's policies as contradictory. In the aftermath of the debate, supporters of Liz Truss argued that Sunak's interruptions were a result of his entitled background. "He came across like a public school mansplainer," said one. One Sunak supporter claimed that Liz Truss did not understand the economy. She was once again out of her depth, the MP said. Conservative Party grandees spoke out in the hours before the debate, pleading for both parties to resist from trashing the brand. But the tensions that have been building continue to manifest themselves, with Liz Truss declining to distance herself from comments by a supporter, the Culture Secretary Nadine Dorries, who outraged some fellow Tory MPs by comparing Rishi Sunak's Savile Row suit and Prada shoes to Liz Truss's £4.50 earrings from Claire's Accessories. "I'm not going to give Rishi fashion advice. I mean, I have said he's a very well-dressed man. I'm not going to give him fashion advice," said Liz Truss, when challenged about Nadine Dorries' comments. Lord Maud, the former party chair and minister for the Cabinet Office, had told the BBC's PM programme ahead of the debate, "One is obviously going to win the leadership, but if the behaviour of the teams and their language has been uncontrolled and it has damaged the party's standing or the way people see the party, then it could end up being a Pyrrhic victory." He said that the increasingly fractious tone of interventions from the campaign teams over the weekend had begun to appear like a race over who can sound more right-wing, as if that's the only game in town. Allies of Rishi Sunak said it was no secret that he had to make a significant impression in the debate, with opinion polls suggesting he's trailing his rival. But one campaign source said the polling from both YouGov and Conservative Home showed a wider gulf between the candidates than they had detected, and said many members were currently undecided. Liz Truss has strictly limited her broadcast appearances and has thus far declined to be interviewed by veteran political journalist Andrew Neil, who will go head-to-head with Rishi Sunak on Friday. Channel 4 said it was still hoping to convince Liz Truss to take part. Allies of Rishi Sunak have suggested he will take numerous broadcast opportunities in order to highlight one of his own strengths versus Liz Truss's perceived weakness. In previous multi-candidate debates, Liz Truss has polled badly with the general public, whereas Rishi Sunak came top in one debate and second in another. Earlier on Monday, 25th of July, Sunak teased his rival with a tweet, "Just me then," and a wink as Channel 4 announced the interview with Andrew Neil. Liz Truss's refusal echoed that of Boris Johnson, who refused to be interviewed by Andrew Neil during the 2019 general election campaign. Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss will take part in another head-to-head debate on Talk TV on Tuesday night and face off again at the first of members' hustings in Leeds on Thursday night.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith which has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And this hadith is about the reward of a person who dies on the way to Hajj. Obviously, this hadith was even more significant and important for the people of the past. You know, in the past, people, before the advent of, you know, modern means of transportation such as planes, trains, automobiles, boats, and these kind of things, in the past, when people wanted to perform the pilgrimage to Mecca and perform the Hajj, this was a very dangerous journey. You know, a lot of people died along the way from sickness, from highway bandits, they were robbed. And, you know, it was sometimes a journey that took many, many years. It's interesting to note that an historian, in one of his accounts, relates that a Muslim from China, you know, he made the journey to pilgrimage to Mecca. It took him more than 30 years. Almost half of the life of this person was spent in this journey going to and back from this pilgrimage to Mecca. Right, so this was a very perilous, a very dangerous journey, and a lot of times, you know, that's why a lot of times people, when they wanted to make the journey to Mecca, they came, they gathered their family, and, you know, they made their final will and testament because they never really knew if they would come back or not. So this is something, therefore, and you may know that it's been related in a tradition that the more difficult an act of obedience is, the more reward it has, right? Perhaps it is for this reason that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, whoever dies on the road to Mecca, man mata fi tariqi Mecca, dhahiban aw ja'ian. Meaning, if somebody dies on the road to Mecca, regardless of whether he dies on going there or returning from there, this person will be safe from the great terror on the day of resurrection. You'll be saved from the terror of the day of resurrection on the day